Did you know that serial killer Ted Bundy once did volunteer work for the suicide hotline? It's true. He saved many lives. Of course, on his off hours, he murdered many women. But I estimate that during his year-long tenure with the crisis line, he may have saved more lives than he took. One could argue that the math was even. But one could also argue the unfairness of killing people who wanted to live and saving people who wanted to die. In any case, it's not something I think about a lot. You are listening to Notes from the Uncanny Valley with Gib Strange. The official recycling bin disappeared from the lobby some weeks ago. For a while, people were leaving their junk mail on the floor in the same place, as though the bin were still there. Today, a plastic cat litter box has appeared with a handwritten recycle sign taped to it. In order to check mailbox number 525 down on the bottom row, I have to bend at the waist. This bowing is made more demeaning by the fact that I rarely get mail worth getting. Often, without bothering to hunch over, I open the box and fish my hand around. Today I only feel the familiar cheap newsprint of junk mail. Usually I just let it pile up until the box is full and then remove it all at once. But today feels like a take-action kind of day. The dry, tactile experience makes me cringe. It is to the touch as nails on a blackboard are to the ear. Does everyone feel this way, as I've always assumed, or is it an indication of some mild sensory processing disorder? Depending on the quality of the paper, even turning a page in a book can send an unpleasant shiver up my arm. Since the presence of an old crimson-colored litter box also means the absence of a cat somewhere, I feel uneasy about dropping my share onto the small mountain of unsolicited leaflets. In my moment of hesitation, I notice something on the back page of the flyer. This sheet is usually a three-quarter page of pizza coupons and an orange block at the bottom that always asks the same question. Have you seen me? Today, me is two faces. On the left, an old snapshot of a teenage runaway who's been missing for 13 years, and on the right, the computer-generated estimation of the woman she would be today. In the first image, the 19-year-old Hispanic girl is looking at the camera with a slight smile. The frame has been closely cropped around her face, giving no context to her life. Nothing extraneous, only her face. Her hair is pulled back, her eyebrows are neatly plucked, and her teeth show just above her lower lip, which is much larger than her upper lip. A small mole punctuates the corner of her smile. A three-quarter profile shot, the partially hidden side of her face shows her left eyebrow raised ever so slightly. This is an expression children learn as they grow up. She looks like a child looks when a child is trying to look like an adult. It's an expression meant to seek attention, to allure. It asks a question and invites an answer. Roughly translated, it means, I see you. Do you see me? Meanwhile, the age-progressed picture to the right is a perverse and distorted version of the first picture. It is not the face of someone who has lived 13 more years of life, much less 13 years of a missing person's life. Aside from causing the raised eyebrow to look like a grotesque deformity, The computer manipulation has left her physically still very much a child, but no longer a cute one. Also, the expression she wears has been altered enough to change the question being asked. It's certainly not asking, "Have you seen me?" as the text above suggests. Now it only seems to say, "I'm looking right through you, and I don't give a shit if you see me." Strangely, there are other alterations in this image. It's not as tight a close-up. It's been given a gray background meant to resemble the cloudy shades of canvas found in professional portrait studios. And the woman has been given an open-collar shirt to wear with pink and blue floral print. The importance of these added details is unclear. This type of creative image processing is sometimes reversed when a corpse is found that has already decomposed beyond recognition, making identification difficult. With no leads and no matching dental records, forensic authorities enlist artists to recreate the facial features of the decedent. Drawings, clay busts, and computer-generated images of what the person may have looked like in life are produced to aid the search. The results are even further removed from reality than the age-progressed estimation of the missing person I stare at this morning. These nameless but familiar folks look just like the anonymous strangers you pass at the grocery store, and but for a misstep of drunken fate, you yourself might lose your life and identity, only to be reborn as some vague recreation of your former self in a world of total simulacra. Take a moment online to search out these poor fictive illuminations of life's unknown soldiers. Spend some time with them, as I have. Each has a personality and a history. Look carefully. I suddenly realize that somewhere out there, a forensic reconstruction of Carla may exist. That's her name, by the way. Carla. As I look at the two images, it occurs to me that if she is alive today, and let's face it, that's a pretty big if. But if she is alive, the 32-year-old woman couldn't possibly resemble the apparition depicted on the right, and would probably not recognize the simulated face. But it's safe to imagine that she would remember the 19-year-old child pictured on the left. And would Carla finally know all the answers to all the questions those neatly plucked eyebrows were asking all those years ago? I drop the sheet of fast food coupons addressed to resident onto the pile, where it falls on top of a copy of itself. It lands in a curious juxtaposition. Combined with the copy below, a collage is created, and the picture on the right, the distorted, age-progressed picture, appears twice, or rather, 1.5 times. The other copy, being underneath the one I just tossed, is partially obscured. I take a moment to read the accidental triptych from left to right. The snapshot of the teenage runaway with the impish smile, the synthetic forgery of the ghost woman in the middle, and finally, only the truncated left half of the ghost's face, isolated and strange, ominously peeking out with a sick, baleful eye. My next door neighbor believes his downstairs neighbor is using psychotronic warfare to torture him in the night. His response to the perceived assault is to pound on the floor with his cane, usually in a steady 5 hard tap sequence. Sound travels funny in these apartments. What sounds like it's coming from one side is often coming from the other side. Sometimes you don't know if a noise is above you or below you. I heard the knocking in my sleep shortly after he moved in. In retrospect, it's interesting to consider that my awareness of his nightmarish reality had its beginnings in a dream I can't remember. One morning in the elevator, I spoke with the neighbor in 523. I asked if she'd knocked on the wall in the night. She hadn't, but seemed to know what I was talking about. She told me she'd had a bad night's sleep, full of strange dreams, she said. The tapping continued. For a while, I wondered if some kind of secret code was being communicated between apartments. When I finally realized where it was coming from, I began to listen at the wall separating his room and mine. Sometimes I heard him mumbling obscenities and saying the name Dietzen, whom I've since gathered is his downstairs neighbor. He'd often repeat things in threes. For instance, "Fat boy downstairs, fat boy downstairs, fat boy downstairs." I learned that my next door neighbor's name was Sam. Arnold in 521 thinks Sam looks like Billy Bob Thornton, but at a stocky 6'3" or better, Sam is more like a funhouse mirror version of the Hollywood star. He wears thick glasses that magnify a growth on his right eyelid and sometimes walks with a cane. When Sam would see me in the hall, he'd ask if I hear noises in the night. Before I could respond, "You mean the tapping?" he'd say, "Sounds like Star Trek noises." I said no, I hadn't heard that, but that I was hearing some tapping or knocking. We repeated this conversation on a few occasions, during which time it became apparent to me that this man's mental emotional state was not well at all. And yet I didn't want to come to any premature conclusions. I was still ruling out external sources of the noise. Maybe he was hearing the electronic chirps of the toy mouse Stranger and I play with at night, but the timing never lined up. Perhaps he was hearing something over in 529, or even up in 627, I thought. Then the screaming began, like a man being electrically shocked. In the morning, I knocked on his door and asked if he was okay. "No, I get these terrible migraines, and that guy downstairs, I don't know if he thinks it's some kind of game or what, but he's got some kind of ray gun he's using at night." Pausing to wipe sweat from his brow with a washcloth, Sam continued, "I've told management. They don't want to do anything about it, though." Then he gave me a hard look and asked, "Did you complain to them about me?" I shook my head no, and backed away slowly, saying, "I hope you feel better." "He's a crazy person," Sam reiterated one last time before closing the door. Lately, the mumbles and screams coming from his apartment are more and more disturbing. I'm tired of waking up in someone else's nightmare. A psychologist once told me that the most emotional person in the room controls the room. That is, everyone in the room has to react in some way to that person. It's a horrifying thought, don't you think? The person with the least control over themselves has the most control over others. Of course, in this case, the most emotional person in the room is in the next room. The real problem is that Sam's problem is real. His screams of pain are real, making the ray gun as real as anything else. This is the real problem because it leads to the next problem, which is that the ray gun is not real for his neighbors, or management, or assume, the vast majority of what the Greeks called the Koinos Cosmos, or shared world. Nevertheless, it's becoming a real problem around here. It's becoming our problem, which can only lead to more problems.